Good evening, it's very nice to see you all here tonight. I'm Emily King and I curated the Alan Fletcher Show that recently finished. I'm delighted to welcome Colin Forbes here tonight. As you all know, Colin was Alan's first work partner in the very start of the 1960s. He founded Fletcher Forbes and Gill with Alan Fletcher and Bob Gill in 62, Crosby Fletcher Forbes in 65, and Pentagram in 72, and then left London to found the New York office of Pentagram and to relaunch Pentagram in the wider world in 1978. I only met Colin for the first time last night, which is really extraordinary because I've been working and thinking about Alan's work for so long. And really, if you're looking through Alan's work in the 1960s, Colin's work is always there, both the design and his efforts to construct the company. And in a sense, it's been a kind of thread of the show all the way through Colin's input. So it's a real honour and a pleasure to meet him. And tonight, I hope we're going to hear some of Colin's story.
I've obviously been thinking about this evening, but I don't have any prepared speech, and I thought what I would do is just, you know, reminisce about our progress. I think I'm going to tell you a story. The focus of the story really is about focus, and it's about courage, and it's about luck. Those three things are essential ingredients to both, you know, Alan's and my life, in that it was luck that we met, in a way, the luck that we both went to the Central School and all of those things followed. The first project that Alan and I did together was that Alan had been at Hammersmith and they, I didn't know, but they had submitted for a float for the Chelsea Arts Hall. But students, if a student got a float accepted, then a little gang of students could go and then you would get free drinks and free dinner there for New Year's Eve. I mean, it's a real event. So I think it was my idea that we did a dinosaur. And you know, you have a toy snake and it's got hinges. And if you twist it, it wriggles like this. Well, we thought we could enlarge this up so it could be the neck of the dinosaur. We were organising this and we went down into the foyer or whatever of the Central School and we had to make a phone call. So I said, Alan, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't have any change. And he says, you don't need change. He says, the telephone engineer taught me how to dial and the number backwards and so you could get a call without putting coins in. So I looked at him and I thought, this is a real cool cat. Being at the school and just being together changed Alan's and my life. Alan wasn't Mozart. Alan wasn't an infant genius. Alan had a talent, obviously, to be in the school at all. But Alan, somehow or other, managed to exploit every ounce of every part of his brain and his talent, I think. I think that's what he's saying about, you know, the focus and determination was the first thing, to use those talents to the maximum. Well, I think the timing and the luck comes in is that the college in Yale had agreed that they would exchange professors. And then they decided they wanted to send a student. They wanted to exchange a student to do their final year in the other college and get there. And so other people weren't so entrepreneurial. I don't know that anybody else particularly sort of fought for the job. But Alan says, it's going to be me, you know. And they managed to organise, I think it's as many, to get the money to get together, as many as four grants. And also, extraordinarily so, is that he arrived at Yale, again in its golden period, is that Paul Rand was still there, and two emigres, Joseph Albers and Herbert Matter, were there. And in some ways, I actually considered, despite all his education, that Alan, in a way, was self-taught, because he managed to get more out of these people than many other people that went through these courses but didn't actually get as much out of it as Alan. He was fascinated with, obviously, Rand, because that constant graphic design. But Albers was a dedicated abstract painter, and he said once to Alan, "You don't want to go in those live classes drawing tits and bums." He said, "You know, what you want to do is to do serious colour studies." Albers had this very good colour course. 15 years later, I was doing a series of posters for Congress. Well, it was a mailing, and the idea was he wanted a mailing that could be repeated, and I thought, well, 52 weeks in the year, and he wanted to promote his alphabet, so there are 20 successors in the alphabet, you multiply that by 2 and you've got 52, which is a sort of irrelevant idea that actually interested both Alan. And I did absolutely no decision poster. There was a square at the top, and I would get the letter in as big as I could, and I'd get the alphabet across the bottom. And I'm working on this, and I've got the Pantone swatches or whatever. And Alan says, "What are we doing?" I said, "I'm trying to choose the colours for these 26 posters. I said, "Look, Albers would have said, you need a system." He said, "Why don't you get the colour circle? And we divide it into 12 parts. And if you do colour and ground, you're going to have 24 combinations. And then add black and white." It was a revelation, because in fact, I mean, all of the sort of decisions, do I like this or should it be this size or that size, the solution was really totally mechanical, you know, when it came from that. The strange thing was, is when the collection of posters, you could see that there was a system behind it, but you would have to think very hard to work out what that system was. And, you know, oddly enough, I actually don't know why, but that collection of posters ended up in the V&A. But all of that is because Alan went to Yale and he met Alphas, you know. But what we did have, we had a phenomenal New York-London connection. And so Rand or he was in San Francisco, or Bass, or Lou Dorsman, if they came to New York, they would automatically call us. We'd have little parties and stuff. And somehow or other, that managed to lift the vision. So we had a bigger vision, I think, than our competitors. Yeah, Alan's background was well educated in the best schools. And it was a mixture of, you know, American ideas and more than typography and sort of, you know, Swiss design. Bob, one of his better quotes, said, "Look, if you can't explain it over the telephone, you don't have an idea. It shouldn't be sold on the detail of its art, it has to be an image." And so from this, and last night came up something that was Michael Wolff said, you know, about how much he admired the Evening Standard posters we did at that time, you know. So it's like it's a non-design thing, have a found object, which is the sold sign, you know, with their Evening Standard, there's nothing else. I mean, again, it's a bit like the same philosophy for the Conway's posters, there's not all sorts of little itsy-bitsy design decisions. The thing about Fisher, Forbes and Gill was that we met every Monday morning, and we would go through every job that was in the house or every job that had come into the house. And what you'd do is you'd say, "I've gotten this new project," and explain what the issue was, and "I thought I'd do this." And the other two might say, "Great." In which case, you go away not thinking, you just get it done. You don't, you know, worry about it anymore. Or they might say, "You know, I've got a better idea," or "What about this?" Or, "No, that's been done before. You know, let's think some more," etc. But that relationship is very hard looking back on actually to remember whose was what. And anyway, we did agree that anything that would be, that was done in that period, would actually really belong to the three of us. It's a pity, because it's good and it's bad, everything changes, and it actually came up about the scale, is that it's not sustainable. There are two reasons, I think. One is that we got busier, and we were out more often, and traveling, and seeing clients, and this, that, and that. The other is we amalgamated with Crosby, which was architecture, etc., which is, you can't include that, you know, within it. So gradually the system broke down to the extent that it became more team-oriented. And as you probably know, you know, Gil left. I've gone through that in order to get us to Pentagram, right? A couple of things about Pentagram, I think, is that we did our first book because we had to transfer somehow goodwill from what had been two fairly well-known names, which is Kenneth Grange and Fletcher Fawkes Gill, into something or other. So when we actually came up, or Alan came up with the idea for Pentagram, we published a book, which was the work of five designers, I think. About 3 or 4 years later, the book was reasonably successful. We decided to do a book, and it was called Living by Design. I think, thinking back on it, we decided also that the first book was really just a catalogue with a cover on it. It was just examples. We were trying to do a book that explained what we did. And I think I'm almost certain that the Living by Design was Alan's idea, the actual title. And that we all believed that we tried to do that, you know, that we actually tried to live the same way in the office as we wanted to live at home. But Alan was probably the prime example of the fact that the studio and the house, and if you go to the house and the people that have sat there and you're a round table and you have dinner, and that you're in a designer's house. And I think, on the other hand, also is that the studio is as informal and unstructured with no separate offices as possible. So that concept of living by design was really very important. We were very keen on being part of a community. Because of the kitchen, we would have dinner parties in the office, and we would invite a journalist and a photographer and one client and maybe even a competitor. And the same thing is that many, many people have sat around the Fletcher's table, you know, and have been mixed on different disciplines from, you know, Carol Rice or whatever. So that idea, and we also wanted the office, and I think Theo was very keen, that he would have various architectural meetings, etc. We wanted the office to be somehow or other a part of the design community. And he began to write. And he started working on what I think is one of the most remarkable books, which is The Art of Looking Sideways. I mean, it is a real serious contribution to our profession. I have a nice story, which I think is that I was staying with, and maybe it's a couple of years ago, I was staying with Alan on Power, and they book a minicab for me. And the driver comes up and takes my case and puts it in the car, and he gets in, and he's a middle-aged man with a mid-European accent. He said, "Excuse me, sir." He said, and he'd come to the door, and he'd seen Alan, had a little peek into the studio. He said, "Is your friend an intellectual?" It's just not a term that they generally use. You're an artist or this or that. I mean, it seemed to me always it has sort of mid-European connections. And I thought about it. And I said, yes. And it was a little bit of a revelation to me that Alan, in his sort of his last career, had become a serious intellectual, you know, and a real, you know, contribution.
Alan always said that he never imagined that you could make a living out of art and design. I mean, that's why. I mean, his mother had sent him to art school hoping that he would become an art teacher, and that was the best she imagined, and that he never imagined that you could make a living. And it was, you were already, as a student, you were already making a bit of a living with art and design. You were already doing illustrations for magazines. Is that true?
Yes, that's true.
He was the person. I mean, how come you imagined you could make a living out of art and design?
I think the strange thing is, when it comes to history, is that when we were students, I probably, without undue modesty, drew better than Alan. And I had a couple of jobs with magazines and so forth. Alan, you know, just because of compulsion, passive passion or whatever. I mean, drew everywhere he went, all day, every day, and I didn't, because he vastly overtake me, and I can't draw for pleasure. It's just not. So that was interesting. It also affects, you know, me. You have such limited ambitions. I mean, I had thought when I was a student, if I had a little bit of freelance work, and I was head of the department at the central school, I mean, that has to be the end of your career, not the beginning, you know. So I think, you know, is it to say that the parents have no idea of what it is you do. I mean, Saul Bass, I think it's Saul Bass, tells the story, and maybe it's to old hat, but, you know, the mother says, what do you do? Oh, she said, I do ads. She said, well, do you take the pictures? He says, no. Do you set the type? He says, no. Do you draw anything? He says, no. And she said, that's a wonderful job you have, right? And again, I think it's also, you did talking about going into a profession that didn't exist, whatever it is, 55, 60 years ago.
Alan constantly talks about being in the right place at the right time, and so do you, and you always talk about luck and opportunity, and yet you spent your childhood in the 40s and 50s, which must have been some of the most grim and difficult times in Britain, and in a sense I think graphic science today have many more opportunities, and it's a much easier life, and it's not really a question, but don't you think it's all about how you interpret what you're given, rather than what you're actually given? In some ways, you and Alan have an immensely positive spin on your histories, an immensely positive attitude, and that's why you achieved what you did.
Yes.
It's just an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's
the positive attitude that's the key, because in a way, the adversities are an advantage. Every big risk I've taken has been worth it. And the things that, you know, I haven't done have not been worth it.
Wasn't 1978 wasn't exactly a prime time to go to New York? Was it quite a grim period?
Again, that's irrelevant. 1979 or 80 were one of the depressions in New York. They're actually like 2001 was or something. But the thing Alan and I often talk about is that when you're that small, the economy can be phenomenal, and you can be out of work, and the economy can not be very good, and you get one good client and you're fine, you know. So in fact, I mean, you can't even think about that, because you don't know what the economy is going to do. But it was not a good time.
What about computers? Do you think that at an early stage they would have liberated you or destroyed your creativity?
It's interesting. I would have said that you would presume that would destroy creativity. Not so. And I think back to the Crosley Fletcher Forbes days. I used to do a catalogue for a building company. And it would take about three people to get this catalogue out. And you were having repros that you had to, and if it was a correction, you had to get the blade and space it. And then you're making photostats and this, that, the other. And if you wanted to make a change, you know, there was a huge expense in having everything done. You set a page up on the computer and you flick it. And what you've got in terms of creativity is choice. You can immediately see it in 52 different typefaces without sending it out the door, you know. So I think that it reduced an enormous amount of, like, almost like slave labor, you know. It may have reduced the number of employees, but it has enormously.